Good evening and welcome to Amandla. You're on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Amandla is your 1 hour African current affairs and analysis program. And I am sitting virtually with Doug today. Doug, you've put together the show, so I'm going to pass it on to you to introduce what's in store for tonight.
Well, thank you very much, Gwen. Normally, listeners to Amandla will remember that we've been interviewing Farid Omar for background and information on the Ethiopian and the Horn of Africa whenever there's issues going on there. Well, we have the opportunity this time to thank Stefan Christophe from Free City Radio, who interviewed Farid on our behalf. Not on our behalf, but we're using an interview he did, and we'll rebroadcast that tonight, about bringing some really good context to the Ethiopian situation and the more recent evolution of things going on there. And then I came across a Guardian article, and I've got Jaha Dukure from the Gambia, and we'll play some more from her about what she's planning with all her activities around female genital mutilation. But more recently, she's joined the political process and has some really cool ideas. So stay tuned to Amandla.
Good day. You're tuned into Free City Radio. This is the 69th edition. Thank you for being with us. Today on the program, I'm going to be speaking with Abdul Hamid Mohammed, who is a member of GRILA, which is the Groupe de Recherche pour la Libération d'Afrique, the Research Group for the Liberation of Africa. That's an organization that has worked now for a few decades to highlight freedom struggles in Africa. It's a pan-continental organization. And so I got in touch with them because given the current context in Ethiopia, I was thinking it would be important to have a broader analysis, a historical analysis around the current situation in Ethiopia. So GRILA, again, is the Groupe de Recherche pour la Libération d'Afrique, the Research Group for the Liberation of Africa. And I was really honored to speak this week to Abdelhamid Mohamed. I'm basically just going to share what he said. And thanks again to Abdelhamid for taking the effort to really go over in detail some context for Ethiopia today.
Obviously, there is a link between, you know, the broader analysis that you put forward about resisting colonization in Africa. Ethiopia fought historically against colonialism. That included many different communities within Ethiopia, against Italian colonialism particularly. Can you sort of locate what's been happening recently within sort of a history of struggles within Ethiopia that have often clashed? There's various visions of what Ethiopian nationalism is. I'm just wondering if you could try to help us in sort of locating the current moment within a historical continuum.
Yes. In 1934, when the monarchy was established under Emperor Haile Selassie, Ethiopia was effectively a monarchy from that time until 1974, when Haile Selassie was overthrown by Colonel Mengistu Haile Mariam and a group of Marxist members of the Ethiopian military in 1974. So the monarchy was essentially a very centralized state, and Ethiopian, the landed class owned almost much of the land in Ethiopia. The peasants had little access to the land. So it was a very centralized system in terms of the government, but also the economy was in the hand of a few elites who controlled the means of production. And then in 1974, the Dadi regime, the military junta took over, overthrew Haile Selassie, abolished the monarchy, and set up a Marxist government. Some would say it was a pseudo-Marxist, but it embarked on a land reform, a very aggressive land reform that changed land ownership system in Ethiopia, so that a lot of the peasants and the poor people had now access to land. Land was distributed. I think this is one of the achievements of the Dag, sometimes in Ethiopian Dergi military junta. But the Dergi military junta clashed with the opposition, Marxist and socialist groups that wanted more independence and preferred a vanguard party to run the Ethiopian state. But the military, especially Mengistu Haile Mariam, believed that the military should be the vanguard party and the military should be let alone to rule. So there was a clashes, internal clashes between the military government and opposition leftist groups. But there was also ethno-nationalist clashes. For example, the Eritrean People's Liberation Front was looking to secede from Ethiopia. At that time, Eritrea was part of Ethiopia in the 70s. And so they formed the EPLF, led by Isaias Afwerki, who is now the president of Eritrea. And then there was also the TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, which was founded in 1975, led by Meles Zenawi, was also fighting against the military junta. So Ethiopia was technically in a civil war during all the period it was under Mengistu Haile Mariam, that is from 1975. He effectively actually took control in 1977, because before him there was Teferi Bante, who was assassinated in February 1977 due to internal battles within the military junta. And then, so from 77 until 1991, the civil war raged on in Ethiopia in different parts of the country, but mostly in the north, in the Tigray and Eritrean regions. And then in 1991 May, the military junta was overthrown by a coalition of rebels, the Ethiopia's People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, of which the TPLF were the main actors. So after that, Meles Zenawi became the Ethiopian prime minister, and Ethiopia was technically became a federal state, and the system that was adopted was ethno-federalism, of which different ethnic groups in different parts of the country could have a level of autonomy to self-govern within their regions, where they had their own legislators and their own parliamentarians and their own presidents. For example, the Oromia state had its own government and its own president and its own police force. The Somali regional state, the same as well. And so was the Tigray state, Amhara state, and all other states. In the beginning, there were nine regional states. I think now there are about 10. So Ethiopia became an ethno-federalist state. So the idea was first to decentralize power and to give the regions a level of autonomy, but also to restore cultural and language rights that were taken away by the monarchy in 1941, when all languages, including Oromo language, of which the Oromo are the largest ethnic group, were all banned, and only Amhara was allowed as the official language, language of government, language of instruction in schools. And when the Meles Zenawi came into power and established the ethno-federal state, language rights were restored to the regions. For example, in Oromia, people can learn in Oromia language in their schools, the same with the Somali region and the same with the Tigray, Sidama regions as well. But the TPLF controlled the coalition. It was the most powerful actor. The other coalition members were the Oromo People's Democratic Party, the Amhara National Movement. So those are basically, and the TPLF, those were the key four regional, four key actors, but the TPLF was the most powerful and it dominated the government. During the time of Meles Zenawi, Ethiopia looked eastward to China. It adopted the developmental state that was loosely modeled on the East Asian models of state building. So what happened was it pursued a developmental model that was supported and financed by China. And the country saw development in key areas, especially infrastructure, the building of roads and highways, universities, referral hospitals and more, and also the biggest and most vital infrastructure, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. So there was a lot of development that was funded by Chinese, by cooperation between Ethiopia and China. And then after Meles Zenawi died in 2012, Bizalen Hailemariam took over. Still, the TPLF wielded a lot of power. But in 2015, uprisings began against the TPLF. Even though the system was ethno-federalist, it was still a dictatorship, and the TPLF wielded a lot of power. So there were uprisings in the Oromia state and Amhara state, but mostly in the in Oromia. And there was a huge rebellion inside Oromo state, and mostly led by the youth. And they were able to bring down the government of Desalegn Haile Mariam, and he had to resign. And then in 2018, that is when he was brought down. And then Abiy Ahmed, the current prime minister, was appointed actually by a vote in parliament, in the Ethiopian parliament, to become the new prime minister. Once he became prime minister, he started right away quarreling with the TPLF, which he saw had too much power. And Abiy Ahmed wanted a different kind of government, mostly a centralized state. But he also initially reached out to the West and started implementing new liberal economic policies, because Ethiopia was caught in a debt trap from the Chinese loans, and it was difficult for them to continue with the Chinese to continue with direct aid. So Abiy Ahmed decided to look to the West and started implementing some partial privatization as part of the new liberal project. The TPLF in the North still preferred the developmental state model and also wanted the ethno-federalism to remain intact the way they articulated it during their reign. And also because every regional state are supposed to hold their elections every 5 years, the elections in Tigray were due in August 2020. But it's the same with other regions as well. But the Ethiopian government canceled all regional elections and also the federal elections that were due in August 2020, citing the COVID pandemic. The TPLF in the North went ahead with the elections in defiance to the central government. And then on November 4th, 2020, the Abiy Ahmed government claimed that the TPLF had attacked its northern command military base located near Mekelle, the capital of the Tigray region, and said that this is the last straw. And so he ordered the Ethiopian National Defense Forces into Tigray to topple the ruling regional party, TPLF. And he termed it as a law enforcement measure. But Ethiopia was heavily backed by Eritrean forces because the TPLF was heavily armed. It has ruled Ethiopia for almost 30 years, and they had in their possession a lot of weapons, and much of the Ethiopian army during the TPLF rule was largely Tigrayan. So Abiy Ahmed relied a lot on Eritrean forces and also Amhara militia. And Eritrea also saw it an opportunity to set a course with the TPLF, because during the Ethiopian Eritrea war in 1998 and 2000, Ethiopia was able to reoccupy a disputed area called Badme, that according to the UN is actually part of Eritrea, but the TPLF claimed that it was part of Ethiopia. So Eritrea had scores to settle with the TPLF. And so before that, in 2018, Abiy Ahmed struck a peace deal with Eritrea, which ended technically ended the hostilities between Ethiopia and Eritrea. So what happened was, in the early stages of the war, the TPLF was dislodged from the regional capital, Mekelle, and it retreated into the mountains and waged a guerrilla warfare, a fierce guerrilla warfare. And by end of June this year, in 2021, they were able to drive out the Ethiopian National Defense Forces and the Eritreans and the Amhara militias from almost the entire of Tigray region. And then they pushed southwards into the Amhara and the Afar states, where they captured a lot of cities and towns. And 2 weeks ago, they were able to capture some very strategic cities like Desi and Kombolcha and Kesi. These cities lie on the Ethiopia-Djibouti highway, and so they're very strategic. And they are pushing now the rebels. Later on, the TPLF formed an alliance with the Oromo Liberation Army, which also has been fighting the Abiy Ahmed government. And both rebels are now pushing southwards towards the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. and they are now within striking distance. And last week, the TPLF and the Oromo Liberation Army formed an alliance with 9 other groups, including the Somali State Resistance. And the objective is to bring down the Abiy Ahmed government and then form a new government based on democratic federalism. And so that's where things are heading now. So the rebels now are within striking distance of the Ethiopian capital. There's been some diplomatic activities going on with the former Nigerian president, Olusegun Obasanjo, who is the African Union envoy for the Horn of Africa, is now on the ground in Ethiopia trying to mediate between the Ethiopian government and the TPLF rebels. A few days ago, he traveled to Mekele in the north to meet the grand leaders, and he has also held talks with the Abiy Ahmed government. And Obasanjo said that there is the window of opportunity, but still the positions of both groups are very entrenched. The Ethiopian government is demanding that the TPLF should stop fighting, but also withdraw from Amhara and Afar regions. And it should also recognize the legitimacy of the Abiy Ahmed government. While the TPLF wants the Ethiopian government to lift the blockage on the Tigray region, of which right now there is a humanitarian crisis because much of the aid that was earmarked for the Tigray region is not reaching the region due to a blockage by the Ethiopian government. So the positions of both groups are still very much entrenched despite diplomatic efforts by the African Union envoy to try to resolve this conflict peacefully. So that's how things stand right now.
There's two specific points here. One is the cancellation of the elections in 2020. Can you just detail why that's an important step in what has happened now with an armed conflict? The cancellation of the regional elections, I mean.
Yes, the Tigrayans believe that they had the right to have their elections as scheduled, because elections were scheduled for August 2020, regional election, but and also federal elections. And then they decided, in defiance to the Abiy Ahmed government, which canceled all the elections, citing the pandemic, the Tigrayans decided to go ahead. So this was in direct defiance to the Abiy Ahmed government. They wanted to form to have an election and form entrench TPLF's position, and the Abiy Ahmed government would not saw that as a direct defiance to its power and control in Ethiopia, and so the tension was it was not just about the election, but also a lot of the Tigrayans, TPLF members who were in senior positions in government and military, were purged out from the Abiy Ahmed government. So the Tigrayans believe that they were being targeted unfairly by the central government, and that they had every right to hold regional elections despite the fact that the elections were canceled by the federal government. And so this led to further tension between the federal government and the TPLF. But the last straw was what the Ethiopian government claims was that the TPLF attacked the Northern Command military base in Mekele, near Mekele. But the Tigrayans said that it was a preemptive move because they knew that the Ethiopian defense forces were mobilizing already near the borders of Tigray, ready to attack and dislodge the TPLF. So that's how things got out of hand after the elections were canceled, but the TPLF went ahead with the elections. The Ethiopian government was able to hold federal elections that was rescheduled for June 2021. But the election did not take place in many parts of the country because of insecurity. There was insecurity, of course, in the TPLF region, in Oromia state, in the Somali state, in the Afar state. So the election was seen by many international observers as shambolic. And they were just meant to entrench Abiy Ahmed's hold onto power.
So on this point of the elections, I think there is still like the labeling of the Ethiopian state as a democratic one. Why is it important for us to think about the role of Western states' recognition of Abiy Ahmed's government? Canada particularly has deep economic ties with Ethiopia on various fronts in the financial sector, in mining. Even there are some military contracts. So can you speak a bit about where things stand and also the responsibility of governments, including Canada's, that recognize the current government of Ethiopia within a democratic framework?
The problem is that always Western countries, including Canada, have always paid lip service to democracy in Africa, because they're only interested in having a regime in power that will protect their interests on the ground. So that's what's happening with the case with Ethiopia. And this is not just Ethiopia itself alone. We have seen many questionable elections in other parts of Africa where the incumbent will rig the elections, and then there'll be a few condemnation here and there, but down the road, the Western government are quick to recognize such despotic regimes just to protect their interests. So it's the same with Ethiopia now. Many governments in the West treated the elections as legitimate, but many election observers, independent groups, clearly said that the elections were not free and fair, that it was there was mass rigging during the election, and a lot of candidates, opposition candidates, were prevented from running, and also there was no registration of potential voters in opposition strongholds. That registration took place, almost 80% of the registration of voters took place in government strongholds. The elections were rigged well in advance during the registration of voters. And so the Ethiopian government, in the eyes of many, is not a legitimate one. And that's why the rebels are fighting for a new political dispensation. They want a new government, transitional government of national unity that will pave way for free and fair democratic elections down the road. So that's how the situation stands. And Canada has not used its leverage over Ethiopia, because Ethiopia is one of the largest aid recipients of Canadian international aid. And Canada should have pushed for peace in Ethiopia and should have called for a new direction. For example, it should have called for negotiations between the government and rebels, but also that Ethiopia should hold free and fair democratic elections, and that a new transitional government should be formed. So that's the situation with Canada now. The Canadian government has not used its leverage to demand change and a peaceful transition in Ethiopia.
That was the voice of Abdulhamid Mohamed, who is outlining some important context and background on the current situation within Ethiopia. I thought it was important, beyond the headlines, to look at the ways that the conflict in Tigray region of Ethiopia is rooted in historical realities and trajectories around debates on the
federalist nature of the Ethiopian state, how and in which ways are different communities represented. And so I think that, you know, within this exchange, we hear some more fleshing out of context and details that are so often missing or actually can't be included in a headline. So I really wanted to dedicate the program to Ethiopia today for that context. So thank you so much, Abdulhamid Mohamed, for taking the time to speak with Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph in Montreal. This is the 69th edition. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us.
All right, we're going to go somewhere so special now. And I'm so proud to see my brothers and sisters here in the audience this afternoon. And this is for the beautiful people of The Gambia and all the representatives of The Gambia right here this now. So this song is called Gambia, and it's, of course, in dedication to The Gambia and the Gambians. All right. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It's so beautiful to see your faces here.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, welcome back to Amandla. We're, as I said earlier on, I ran across the music you just heard was Sona Jobarta, and I really love her. She's one of the few female kora players, and she's really excellent and has a tremendous following. And she's from The Gambia. And so we're moving from Ethiopia across the continent to The Gambia, because I read a Guardian article about this young lady, Jaha Dukure, and it was very impressive. She's very articulate and very active and very, very forceful. And so what I found that I could help share with you so that you could get introduced to her is a small intro to her being nominated UN Women's Ambassador to Africa.
A Goodwill Ambassador,
I missed an important word. And she does about a 3-minute, 4-minute presentation of her background and her mission and her goals and her activism, so that she explains herself to you. I don't have to do it. And then she's interviewed because she's now joined People's Democratic Organization for Independence and Socialism in the Gambia, and they're running as an opposition party against the current government, that is facing election this year. And she actually proposed to be president, but she's willing to accept that she, as a young person, has to go through the apprenticeship of an election or two, and she's with the People's Democratic Organization for Independence and Socialism this time, and has lots of ideas to share about the kind of change she'd like to see in Gambia. So stay tuned.
My name is Jaha Dukure, and I am the UN Women Goodwill Ambassador for Africa. I came to New York City on Christmas Day when I was 15 years old to marry a man that I had never met. I think getting married at a young age is the most difficult thing any girl can ever go through. But personally, I believe that when you force a girl to marry, you've given a man a right to rape her every single day. At the age of 15 was when I realized that I went through FGM and what it meant. There are four types of FGM. Because I went through type 3, which is the total removal of the clitoris, the labia, as well as the vagina stitched together so that there's only a small hole to urinate and menstruate, which meant that my marriage couldn't be consummated until I was deinfibulated. That's when I knew that I had gone through FGM, and it meant that I couldn't have sex until I was cut back open. So I think I started anonymously speaking out around the time that I was pregnant with my daughter. I knew that I don't want my daughter to ever go through that. But I also knew that there are millions of girls out there that are just like my daughter, and no one was speaking for them. And if it wasn't me, then who else? And that's the reason why I started speaking out, shouting and using my voice. There was so many opposition within my community. I know that everyone in my family had it difficult. My father had it the worst because people told him that it was his fault that I was out there. It's because I wasn't trained properly. It's because he allowed me to have an education. When I was appointed UN Women Goodwill Ambassador, it was a huge turning point, not only in my family, but in our whole community. I remember they made news about it and the excitement that everyone felt. And I can see how proud my father was. I can see how proud my brothers were. And I was no longer that black sheep of the family that everyone tried to keep away from and distance themselves from. I was now the celebrated hero in my community, the celebrated hero in my country. Women like me and girls like me don't make it this far. So to me, it's a representation of those girls whose voices have not been heard. To me, it's a representation of the 200 million women who have been silenced through FGM, and the millions of girls who continue to suffer with the consequences of child marriage. The current movement against FGM has turned into a global movement from the US to the UK to Africa. I personally believe that we are at a tipping point when it comes to ending FGM. But what we have started seeing more and more is survivors and women from impacted communities are taking the lead when it comes to fighting FGM. And I think that has changed the conversation because we have created a platform where women are leading that change. I think we have a chance. And 2030 can't come any sooner.
Thank you very much. So I'm sure you must have heard about the decision there by popular human rights activist Jaha Dukure. She recently joined DAI. That was a massive decision there by the popular activist. So, I mean, she's my guest today. We'll talk about the reason as to why she decided to join DAI. Over the years, what we have seen is that more and more women are coming, taking ownership of politics in the Gambia. So the decision there by Jaha Dukure to join DAI is something that has been on the lip of a lot of Gambians. She's my guest today. Jaha, thank you for coming.
Thank you
very
you.
Much.
Thank you very much, Lamin, for having me.
Now, out of all the, first of all, let me ask you, this is going to be a general question. Out of all the parties in the country, why Doi?
Because we have a shared value, a lot of the values that I believe in, and the way that I think Gambia can advance, and the Gambia that we all want. I see that Doi shares those same values like I do. And that's the reason why, for me, whatever I join, it has to be something that I'm truly passionate about, and it has to be something that shares my values. And I think Doi is one political party that shares those core values that I have.
Now, tell us about those values.
I mean, for instance, Gambia being one of the poorest countries in the world, I think a lot of Gambians don't understand the concept of socialism. And sometimes when we talk about socialism, especially in the Gambian context and in the PDOIS concept, a lot of people think that we are talking about communism or something that used to happen in China. But then one of the things that we need to realize is socialism is about free education. It's about better schools. It's about free healthcare. It's about better health systems. It's about sharing our wealth. It's not that people can't work to make money, but it's about having more equity in society so that people are granted same opportunities. It doesn't matter if you come from a poor background or you come from a less disadvantaged background or a rich background. You look at Gambia, for instance, some of us that come from somewhat rich families, we have better educations that are a privilege for us. But education needs to be a right for every single Gambian rather than something wherein, you know, the people that are higher in society can get better, like our ministers can send their children to the best schools, wherein the poor Gambians, some of them are sitting on the floor. Recently, we saw on What's on Gambia, wherein children can't even have desks and stools, and we expect them to get that quality education. So for me, it's about equity. It's about doing what's right, which is one of the reasons why I joined PDOIS.
Now, this is a party that has been around for decades. I mean, a party that is older than a lot of parties in this country, actually, aside the
older than me.
Of course, exactly. Parties such as PPP, NCP, for example. But this is a party that has not been able to achieve a lot. When I mean achieve a lot is in terms of taking power, for example. This party has not been able to do that. And you talk about socialism back in the day when they came. One of the arguments that was pushed has to do with the issue of socialism. People really didn't understand this.
Yes.
And the argument that was being pushed is that, you know, what these people are campaigning for is for whatever that you have, you do not own it. You will have to share it. Even some went to the extent of saying, even your wife, you will have to share it. So that held Doi back in terms of growing. I mean, and I'm sure you must have, learned the fact that they has not been able to really grow to that level.
Yes.
I mean, what do you make of that? What is your assessment in terms of where Doi is now and the future?
I mean, to be quite honest, I think that, you know, PDOIS as a party, traditionally the way they've gone about educating Gambians and relating to the average Gambian hasn't been up to the standard that I would personally want to see. But nevertheless, I believe that everyone agrees in this country that Khalifa Sala is very honest, and Sidya Jatta, as well as the people that represent that party, they've shown us time and time again that they will constantly put our country first and the needs of the Gambian first. So aside from the socialism for a poor country like the Gambia is what we need. Because if we're talking about corporate banking and community banking system, these are things that would benefit every average Gambian. It's not about taking something from someone that they already have, but it's ensuring that the basic things that people need in this country are provided to them. Yes, I do think that Doi needs to speak more of the language of the people. And I do believe that people have a misconception about PDOIS, wherein they believe that it's a party that is for intellectuals and people that are highly educated and they can't talk to the average Gambian. So I think as a party, we need to take these criticisms well, and we need to figure out what is it that for the past 30 years that we have not done so that the average Gambian can see themselves in us. How do we ensure that we change that narrative about the party? How do we ensure that we educate people so they know what these policies are about, so they know what these principles are about, and how they benefit every single Gambian and not just some?
Now you look at the party, the composition of this party. You have the older politicians, the like of Khalifa. I mean, well, these are people that often people will praise and say these are very honest people. These are people who have the Gambia at heart. But then you look at the other aspects in terms of, for example, the young people in the party.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a party that has also given a lot in terms of young people in the party.
Yes.
Till since the 80s, the faces that we have seen is the same faces that continue to be in the party. You are a young person. Joining this party, what have you come to discover in terms of young people being in the lead in
the party? So to me, I think one of the things that I want to make very clear is I did not join a political party. I joined because of my country. I realized that Gambia is at a stage wherein if the likes of myself and the likes of you, Lamin, and other young people don't put themselves out there and realize that we are about putting Gambia first. So it's not about the need for me to be a politician, which is why I decided to join DOI, but it's about making sure that the mistakes that have happened, I mean, you look at the PPP era, you look at the JAMA era, and now you look at the current administration that we have, we all can agree to one thing. Our country is not where we want it to be. And in order for us to accomplish what it is that we want to accomplish, most of us we don't need to wait for someone to give us that opportunity to do what is right for Gambia. We need to do what we believe is right, and by putting ourselves out there. When it comes to DOI and other political parties putting young people ahead, one of the things that we've all noticed, and this is not just a problem in the Gambia, but I mean across most countries in Africa, is that there's a certain level of entitlement, because when people have fought for our freedom, right, and our democracy, and you know, that respect attitude and culture that we have. And a lot of times people see our generation as young and naive and people that don't have the experience or the capability to do some of these things. So I think, you know, there's an argument both ways, whether that's entirely correct or not. And I do believe that with the DOI Congress that just passed, it was people that represented the party that made that decision that they wanted Khalifa as their leader, and they voted democratically to vote in the executive members. And that is not something that, because that's the people that are part of the party, that's what they wanted. And we have to respect that. But I do believe that more parties in this country need to make an effort to include young people. Because when you look at a country like the Gambia, where in 65% of our population is under the age of 35. And this is the population that is going to be voting for the next president. And you cannot have a party where you hold that 65% of your majority back, or even women. And women are not included in political conversations in the Gambia. Young people generally are not taken seriously when it comes to politics. For me personally, I did not join politics to be a politician. I joined PDOIS to help get Gambia to that next level.
So do you think they will be able to, because it's going to, we are in election year, it's going to be a very critical year, and you have the likes of Khalifa Sala who will be right there,
yes,
to battle it out. And you see in the other parties, their leaders are also bracing for what is going to be a very innovating affair. In terms of DOI, do you think DOI will be able to, I mean, DOI's performance has been abysmal, has been bad over the past elections. So if available records are anything to go by, you realize that they have not been able to perform really well at elections. So what are you seeing?
Well, that's because there's a different energy. So what we bring this year is totally different from what you've seen in Gambian politics before.
Yes.
I think one of the reasons why I love and appreciate Khalifa Sala a lot is he's open to new ideas. He's open to working with young people like myself to ensure that we bring that change and momentum into this year's election. So if you guys are expecting us to do business as usual, that's not it. If some of us are willing to put ourselves out there and be at the forefront of this, know that we are not joining this to lose. The only reason why I'm a part of this is because I joined to win.
To win.
And we are going to win.
You are going to win.
We are going to win the 2021 elections.
Amazing. I mean, you go to UDP, they tell you the same thing.
That's the thing.
You go to You go to NPP, they tell you President Barrow will win.
Well, I think they are all wrong. I know, I have my reasons. And trust me, if I have, because Gambian politics has been one thing
so
that...
So President Barrow should start packing up?
I think so, because Gambian politics has been one thing that I've always had this fear of joining politics because of how our politics is. But the reason why I think I built up the courage or mustered the courage to even say that I'm a member of DOI is because I've had several conversations with Khalifa. And not only is his interest for this country right, but I know that it's time that, you know, we give them a chance and do what's right for our country. It's not about the crowds. It's not about the way things have been done. We need to all dig deep within ourselves and start pushing for what would help Gambia get to. And I'm a very jealous person. When I travel across West Africa, for instance, and I see what other countries are doing and how advanced other countries are, and I come back home, this is something that should anger every single Gambian and why we need to do what's right this 2021. We need to ensure that we're voting for the right people.
Now, you look at your party, I mean, DOI, you'll also realize that, I mean, there's a lot of, excitement around, really, I have seen that excitement around the likes of yourself joining DOI. In terms of women in Gambia, you will see that clearly over the years we have seen women taking lead roles in politics in this country. But the younger women in our country aren't very much interested in politics. Well, you will see foot soldiers in the political parties who are women.
Yes.
But you talk about our ladies, they're not very much into politics. And now here is Jaha. What do you have to say about that?
I think it's mostly due to fear, because we're worried that when we join politics, people wouldn't necessarily be concerned about what we have to offer, but they will start attacking us. And no one wants to be in that kind of situation, but it's our moral responsibility. Gambia is our Gambia. This is our country. And whatever we do, it's not something that I'm doing for myself, but we're doing it for our future generations that are to come. And 50% of our population is women. And this is not about what they can do to us, but it's about what we can give back to our country. And I think more young women that are especially watching this today, I think we all need to understand that this is not just their Gambia, this is our Gambia as well. And we have every right, as all the men do, to ensure that we are part of these conversations. Because when you look at our National Assembly, or when you look at policies that are being made, if it's mostly men that are making decisions about our body and our rights, then we have no reason to complain. And the only way we can change that is by ensuring that we are there. And the only way we would be there is by putting ourselves forward for these positions.
And basically you are saying that they shouldn't be afraid
of being
insulted, for example, because politics in Gambia can be very nasty.
I know.
It can be very...
Yes, it can. It shouldn't be that way, though. Yes. I feel like we are all Gambians, and Gambia is so small that we are all family. And I think political parties need to be more matured. Just because I'm part of PDOIS doesn't mean that I'm against UDP, doesn't mean that I'm against President Barrow, doesn't mean that I'm against all the other political parties in the Gambia. It just means that my values as a person identifies more with PDOIS than any of... A lot of my friends are part of UDP, and we have amazing conversations. Like Pater PJ of UDP, he doesn't get along with most Gambians, but he's actually a good friend of mine. And, you know, there's more and more people like that. So I think we just need to be more matured and how we talk about politics in general, and knowing that all of us, there's a common reason why we are in this. It's about Gambia. And we need to keep it at issues rather than personal attacks on someone's reputation or who you think they are. And sometimes going as far as bringing their family into it, I think that's degrading. And that's not the type of politics that I stand for.
Now, let's try to get into Khalifa's mind a little more.
Yes.
Your leader, he will be the person that will be your battle axe in the election in December. Did you meet him? What is he saying? Is he confident that he will be able to finally serve this out? finally cause an upset. Finally, Khalifa president.
So what I love about Khalifa Saleh, I've met him several times. I think the thing about Khalifa that most people might not know is that the first time I met him was in 2016, right after the presidential elections. And then ever since then, since I moved to the Gambia, I constantly go to his office just to dig into his head and see what he's thinking. And I think over the years, he just thought that probably I'm not as serious as, but I wanted to understand, is what I think of this guy, is that truly who he is? And I realized one thing about him. To him, it's not about becoming president. It's more about getting all progressive minds that want to be an architect of our destiny as Gambians to come together and work out a solution for our country. And that is very rare in African politics. You don't see leaders that are saying that it's not about me becoming president, but it's about what would move Gambia forward. And with Khalifa, it's about the issues. Every time I sit down with him, it's about, free education. It's about solutions. It's about healthcare. It's about how do we actually push for system change. So it's not just about, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do. But it's about the solutions that are going to help us accomplish that system change that we need. Because right now, it's not about a regime change. It's about actual system change in the Gambia.
Have you seen any weakness in him at all since 2016?
No, I haven't. I think that he's one of the most decent human beings that I've ever met in my life. His humility is one that inspires me. And I think that, one of the only things that I would say is sometimes I do think that he's a bit rigid.
Exactly. I was going to say that.
I'm sorry. Yes, I do think that he is, sometimes. Because I think I'm different. We can't all be the same, right? Just because I love someone and he inspires me a lot doesn't mean that, there are certain things. So sometimes I do think that the way he thinks and the way the party in general thinks is somewhat too rigid for the average Gambian to understand.
Yes.
But now you have people like me that are also part of the party. And if you know anything about me, is that we don't keep our opinions to ourselves. And Fidio IS is one party that has welcomed those opinions. And I think we are going to have conversations on how to make the best use of what we have. So we bring, the people that are from the opposite spectrum like myself, and then you have the people that are more rigid in how they've done business. But again, this election is not about anything else, but it's about system change, and it's about doing what's right for Gambia. And I think we all need to just come together and ensure that that happens.
Good. Now, let me ask you this. The state of things in the Gambia.
Yes.
I mean, you are a Gambian. You must have seen what has transpired, in terms of our development,
yes,
where we are and where we intend to go to. What is your take on how things look? Because, for example, we are supposed to get a new constitution, but it would appear that is a failed project.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that have been happening over the period. What do you make of in terms of the President Barrow administration and how things are? What have you seen?
Well, I will talk about the constitution, right? I think that there's a huge amount of consultation that was done to get this constitution to where it is right now. We are talking about millions and millions and millions, right? And, the people that were in charge of drafting this constitution went out in our communities and had serious conversations with the people. And I think denying that constitution to go to referendum is denying the Gambian people of their will. And I don't think anyone should be allowed to deny us of our constitutional right and something that we should be able to do. It's not because of politics, it's not because of anything else. And I think what is going on right now is actually denying Gambians of that right that they have. This constitution, this draft constitution, should be allowed to go to referendum. And that way, Gambians can decide if they are going to vote for it or if they are going to vote against it. And that's the only thing that is acceptable to someone like me.
So that just about wraps it up for us here on Amandla today. A big shout out to Stefan Christoph for having shared his material with us. Very nice collaboration, Stefan. And a big thank you to you, Doug. You carried this one on your shoulders. Always greatly appreciated. We do have a couple of things in the pipeline that we hope to bring to you in the next couple of weeks. Some good interviews lined up. But that's it for us this week. Stay tuned now to Jazz Euphoria.